And our very special guest tonight is Dr. Charlie Tart, as we talk about the end of materialism, the bridging between science and spirituality. So get ready for more in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Charlie, you were talking about a fear issue, so let's go back to that. What did you mean by that?
Yeah. So I was saying I was with this group of older, more experienced parapsychologists, and I figure, okay, I'll ask them about whether they've had any fears of parapsychology. You know, because these are people who've sacrificed a lot to do research in this area. They're very knowledgeable and so forth. Mm-hmm. So I asked them if they had any fears, and nobody had anything to say. And I asked them again, and they broke into this kind of abstract philosophical discussion. And, you know, I'm not a hotshot clinical psychologist, but part of me said, there's something funny here. You know, the question's being avoided somehow. So I had this brilliant idea. I said, look, let's do a little thought experiment. And the whole audience can do this little thought experiment. Just assume I've developed a new treatment or drug or something like that, which if I give it to you, will make you telepathically sensitive so you'll know accurately all the thoughts and feelings of everybody within 100 feet of you. And you only have to take this drug or treatment once. You'll have this talent permanently. Now, who wants it?
Yeah.
You feel a little ambivalence there?
Mm-hmm.
Nobody wanted it. And they tried to avoid the question by getting all philosophical again. And I kept having to shout at them, who wants it? Nobody wanted it. So when you even just seriously play with the idea that you could suddenly become very telepathic, you suddenly find lots of reasons why you don't. I've since done experiments, you know, with various other groups of people, having them imagine this and then asking them why they don't want it. And they come up with all sorts of reasons. Like, suppose you were near somebody in a bus or plane or something like that, and you realize they were seriously suicidal. They badly needed help. Are you now responsible for their life? Or you're with somebody you love very much, and now you detect their deep feelings about you, and they really don't like you. Do you really want to know that? We have a lot of desires about what we know and don't want to know, and the idea of something like telepathy coming on strong like that can be very scary. Nobody's really dealing with this scary element of it. Well, I could say, actually, humanity has dealt with it very strongly for thousands of years. They've burned people at the stake that they thought had these kind of abilities. And now we just say the abilities aren't there, and that means we don't have to face up to any fear of it. But that's not really solving the issue of what can they do and should we be afraid of this sort of thing.
Charlie, what does consciousness mean to you?
You're trying it again, George. Good one.
I leak these things in every once in a while.
You're experiencing consciousness right now. Each of our listeners is experiencing consciousness right now. It's our ability to be aware that, you know, we're in a world, there's stuff around us, there are things going on, and we're in it. We have our characteristics. So I'm sitting here, you know, we'll do a little phenomenological study to make this sound very fancy, right? What is my consciousness right now? Well, I'm aware the position my body's in. It's sitting in a chair. There are lights on in the room around me. My computer is on. I'm thinking about the question you just asked and all that. It's the awareness of all those things around this central idea that I exist. That's a good working definition of consciousness for the moment. But again, I don't think it's something we can ever finally define in some way, because one of the many things consciousness does is define things. But why should the part be able to define the whole? Can the spark plug in your car, if they still have spark plugs, define what all the rest of the car is about? They don't have spark plugs anymore, do they? I'm dating myself.
No, I think some of them do.
Some still have spark plugs? That's good.
Absolutely.
That's like electronics, and I think vacuum.
You're thinking of fuel injectors next to old carburetors.
Oh, yeah, right. But anyway, same thing on consciousness. We may not be able to define it, but we can point to it, we can experience it, and we can look at aspects of it and try to make better use of those kinds of things. So like a good question to ask, for instance, might be, well, here you are, your consciousness. Suppose you want it to be psychic. Suppose you want it to be telepathic, you know? Not something real scary like picking up everything from everybody all the time, But, you know, you really hope to get a psychic flash about something or another. We know a little bit about what's likely to make that more likely. We don't know for sure, okay? My experience is if anybody tells you they have a surefire system for being psychic, they might be a charlatan, but more likely they're being honest, but they've got a system that works well for them. But what works well for their mind may not be something that works that well for your mind. So we don't know enough to be able to tell anybody, yeah, we can train you to be psychic to such and such a level. I wish we did. That would be fascinating.
Do you need the brain for consciousness?
For human consciousness, yeah. I mean, it's just like we need the body. We need the brain. That is part of it. You know, I'm a dualist in the sense that I think that mind is ultimately something different from the brain and body. But what we ordinarily experience is the combination of them. It's like if your studio has windows and you look out and you see some cars driving by, those cars are driving around, but those cars are very dualistic in a sense. They've got a person inside them, a driver, that's making them operate the way they do. If they didn't, they're just big paperweights. Okay, it's like our mind is so intimately involved with our bodies that we tend to think that's what mind is. Now, a friend of mine, for instance, was telling me he had to go through some medical treatment where for a while they fixed it so his body did not generate any testosterone at all. He said it was amazing. He totally lost his interest in women. They had no particular appeal to him at all. Now, you know, who wants to think that we're that strongly controlled by chemicals?
Well, but we are. That's our
yeah.
body. Our,
yeah.
Well, but if you believe in the afterlife, if you believe in the subconscious mind doing things, if you die or if the brain ceases to function, those of us who believe in all those other areas believe that thing that continues. So to me, that sounds like you might not need the brain for that to happen.
Yeah, but do you do the same thing, okay? Sometimes, for instance, people have asked me, what's my personal take on the evidence that we survived death? And I tell them I can sum up my personal take for now in two statements. One is that I think that after I die, there may be a period of pain or unconsciousness or something like that, but I won't be really surprised if I regain consciousness in some after-death form. But I will be surprised if I regain consciousness. That is, I think a lot of what I think of as my ordinary identity has a lot to do with being in a body. And without that body there to continuously shape my consciousness that way, I think it's going to be a very different kind of consciousness. It's going to be an altered state.
Well, that may be.
And that, of course, is why one of the things I've studied in my work has been altered states of consciousness. You know, people haven't left their body, but their mind can operate very differently, and that may tell us something about death. Or let me give you another example.
Sure.
Out-of-the-body experiences. When people have an out-of-the-body experience, they find themselves someplace else than where their physical body is. Either they're seeing their body from the outside, or they know it's back in a hospital room somewhere or something. But usually they say their mind is working just like it ordinarily does. They think the same style of thoughts and all that sort of thing. So I tend to define an out-of-the-body experience as your location is different. You're not in a body, but your mind's working the same way. But then you can reason how impossible this is, but it's happening and all that. But in near-death experiences may start with an out-of-the-body experience. You're floating up near the ceiling of the operating room or something mm-hmm. like that. But then the style of your mind starts to change. And that's when people start saying that, you know, I'm trying to describe what I experienced, but ordinary words can't really convey what it was like, or I knew things in a different kind of way, and I can't really tell you what that is. I'm going to give you a little quote that I picked up from one of the discussion lists I'm on, incidentally.
All right.
That's a good reminder here. It's about words. And the quote from a colleague is, although I know they are not the truth, but only at best pointers to the truth, I'm in love with words and infatuated with my own ability to deploy them effectively. This is only ego. May all I say or write be in the service of the divine and not for the gratification of my pride. That was written by a minister, but I really remind myself of that every once in a while, you know. I'm good with words. I think I got a black belt in talking about it the time I was 12 or something like that.
Don't you think, though, Charlie, most people have had some kind of intuitive or paranormal psychic experience?
Yeah. Actually, surveys show that the majority of people feel they've had some kind of personal psychic experience. Now, do they continue to think about it? Do they change their life on the basis? Sometimes. But a lot of times they don't, because a lot of times there's so much social pressure that that's not possible. You must have been sick or hallucinating or something that they forget about it. You know, one of the most common characteristics of near-death experiences is that the person having it doesn't tell anyone about it for months or years.
Well, that's true.
Because they know they're going to get laughed at or thought that they were crazy or something like that. Nightline last night had a very good documentary on near-death experiences. And one of the people they interviewed, a near-death experiencer, was a nurse. And she was saying how, you know, she had sometimes heard patients in the hospital talk about their strange experiences and all that. And when she left, she would usually go and put a note in their chart, check the opiate level in their blood. I think the patient's hallucinating. When she had a near-death experience herself, her attitude changed, but she realized she couldn't really communicate that much.
Well, they even had Bob Woodworth talk about one of his near-death experiences,
yes, right.
The ABC correspondent.
Yeah, I imagine a lot of our listeners saw that particular show, and I think that was a quite good show as these shows go. They had some of the less spectacular near-death experiences presented, probably so people wouldn't get pushed too far. But on the other hand, they didn't have some of the raving pseudo-skeptics talking about how crazy people are to take that stuff seriously.
Isn't that amazing how mainstream media can start to do this?
Yeah, it gives me hope, right? I'm an optimist at heart, even though I see a lot of things that make me pessimistic at the moment.
Well, you know, there's no question about that.
But that's why spirituality is so important. You know, if your only values in life are materialistic, then when the economy crashes, you're in bad trouble. But if your main values are spiritual, you know, the near-death experiences, for instance, say this is a tremendously spiritual experience, and they almost universally say there are two main lessons they learn from it. One is, that if you haven't learned how to love, you haven't passed the course. You haven't made good use of your life. The other is, if you haven't made any contribution to making things better for human life, like discovering new things or improving systems like that, you haven't contributed much. They get a spiritual value that we're here to be good to each other, to improve conditions. And that's much more important than just the material thing. Well, for people like that, if the economy crashes, okay, that's inconvenient, you know, but as long as they still have enough to eat, there are things you can do to help people and the like. It changes your whole outlook on life. You know,
Where do you...
I'm at an age when I'm retired now and I have a reasonable income from the university, and compared to my background growing up poor, I think I'm rich now in a sense. But, you know, if it went back to the level that I lived at as a student or something like that, I could still be quite happy.
Sure. Same with me. It's all relative, isn't it?
Yeah.
You learn how to adapt and how to adjust.
Right. The spiritual values are the most important. But it's really important that people have spiritual values that they've come to themselves. This is where I make the distinction between religion and spirituality a lot. Religion tells you better believe so-and-so because that's the truth and you'll be punished if you don't believe it. And that's one way to try to give values to people. But actually having a spiritual experience, feeling yourself at one with the universe or talking with God or something like that. Incidentally, on that Nightline thing, I was very amused by the atheist minister they interviewed. Because most people, when they have a near-death experience, if they meet a figure of light, they identify it as God or Jesus or something like that. She made it into her kindly uncle, which I think made it much less threatening. I thought that was very interesting psychologically.
Where does intuitiveness fit into all of this?
Intuitiveness is, to me, meaning you're open to promptings that come that don't make logical sense. Sometimes that means actually they're promptings that are really wrong about things, and sometimes they're the creativity of your unconscious, and sometimes it's your ESP operating. You know, when people pick up things psychically, sometimes they know it's something psychic, but a lot of times it's just a feeling, or they call it an intuition, you know. Intuition's a more acceptable word than, you know, I have an intuition instead of I have a telepathic flash or something like that.
Why are some people better than the others? I know you're gonna cite some kind of an example like sports. Why is a football player better than another football player?
As far as psychic abilities go, I can honestly say we do not know. You know, strong psychic abilities have been seen in an extremely wide range of people. As we talked earlier, you know, they're not necessarily more spiritual in an obvious sense. Some of them are as neurotic can be, something like that. We don't know. I mean, there have been research giving people personality tests and all that sort of thing, but the findings are very weak, you know. So if you know that somebody is pretty psychic, that tells you almost nothing about what they're like otherwise at this point of our knowledge.
Does this convince you, Charles, that there could be a higher power, a divine intelligence out there?
Well, that's a tough one, George. Okay, I personally believe that, yeah, there's some kind of God or higher power or spirit of the universe or something like that. I don't know it in the sense that I haven't had some mystical experience where, you know, God stops by and says, young man, it's your job to investigate parapsychology because that's your contribution for this lifetime. That would be nice, especially if it wasn't too scary. Right?
That's right.
But you know, the best I can make out, that's what makes the most sense of the universe to me. And that's what gives me a meaning and lets me care about the it makes me care about other people, but that doesn't express it right, you know. I don't want to say, you know, people should be spiritual because God will send them to hell if they're not good.
Well, I've always had a problem with that.
Yeah, so have I. Yeah, I can remember in Sunday school when they were teaching us about the Ten Commandments, they went into one where they talked about God is a jealous God, and he not only punishes the sinner, but the sinner's children and children's children and children's children's children. And I thought they said under the seventh generation. I think it's actually four. But I remember thinking, wow, that Jehovah is mean. I can't hold a grudge overnight, and he can punish children's children's children, and he's supposed to be a God of love? I had a hard time with that one.
Well, I remember as a little kid, you know, my buddies who are Protestants would say, hey, George, where are you going? I said, well, I'm going to confession. And they said, what is that? And you tell them, well, you go and confess the little things you did wrong, and the priest says you're okay, and then your sins go away, so you don't go to hell. And I said, don't you guys do this? And he said, no, we don't confess to anybody. We just do it within ourselves. And I said, you're going to go to hell. And I'm 14, 15 years old telling these guys this. And I could never understand why they didn't have to go, and I did.
Yeah, I know it was confusing, wasn't it? I was raised as a Lutheran, you know, and I was raised with the prejudice that Catholics, oh, they go and confess, and then they go right back out and sin. But we Protestants, we carry our guilt. We don't get off.
And you still can get to heaven. So we're going to come back in a moment, Charlie, and talk about remote viewing, because you've done some work on that and psychokinesis as well. And then later on, we'll take phone calls and your experiences. That's what I'm interested in tonight, your experiences about some of the things we've talked about tonight. Back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, next hour, we'll take your phone calls with Dr. Charlie Tard and your stories as well. Charlie, tell me about your remote viewing experience and some of the research that you undertook.
Well, I knew the people who did the original remote viewing stuff, Hal Puthoff and Russell Targ.
Giants, yep.
Yeah, we had a regular research group meeting at my home in the Bay Area, actually, back in those early 1970s, because there were a number of us doing parapsychology. And I remember the night they presented their work on remote viewing. It was kind of the first formal presentation of it. And I thought, gee, this sounds awfully good. Parapsychology stuff doesn't usually work this good. I wonder if there's something wrong. But they had a nice trick. They didn't just describe their research. We said, we'll actually do a remote viewing. You know, one of them is going to go and hide somewhere, you know, anywhere within a 20-minute drive of my home. Yeah, well, that narrowed it down to a couple of million places right there. And then after 20 minutes, he said, get a piece of paper and close your eyes, see what kind of images you have, draw them if you have them, write down any descriptive words, see if you can remote view where the outbound person is hiding. So I had a few images come to mind, mainly about, it seemed like a factory with a lot of rotating machinery and bright lights and whatnot. And then the guy came back and took us to the actual remote viewing target. And I thought at first, no, this doesn't match what I drew at all. Until I moved over 2 or 3 feet to look through the window of the laundromat and saw all the dryers and washers going round and round and round in the bright lights. And I thought, oh my God, I actually drew a pretty good sketch of what was going on here. A laundromat is a kind of factory with a lot of machinery going round and round. Well, I eventually became a consultant on the remote viewing program down at SRI. Had to get secret government clearances for that. That was a very unusual thing.
Well, I bet you did. You had to.
Oh, yeah. I ended up getting 2 levels of clearance and having to sign this stuff. And I remember for one of them, if I blabbed any secrets, it was 5 years in jail and a $5,000 fine. But then the other one was 10 years in jail and a $10,000 fine.
That's right. That was a higher security
That's
risk
right.
there.
I can talk about it pretty much now because most of the stuff has come out under the Freedom of Information Act, except some of the operational remote viewings, which are still classified. And basically, it was quite amazing. I had been doing, you know, more conventional parapsychological stuff, trying to teach people to get better at guessing in a multiple choice test. But clearly, remote viewing is a lot more fun. And it worked so well with those particular experimenters at SRI that the interesting thing was when we did a remote viewing that didn't work well. What have we done wrong? What have we done different that seemed to interfere with the process? So we had a lot of very good ones going then. And I was a full-time consultant for about a year there and then kept in touch with it after that. And as you probably know, the government was funding this for
years,
something like 20 years or something like that. And finally, it became relatively public knowledge. And they, of course, didn't want to be associated with woo-woo stuff like remote viewing. And some high official made a statement, you know, that nothing ever came of it, to which the interviewer should have said, how come you guys kept funding it for 20 years?
Yeah, right.
Nothing ever came of it. So it's a very effective way of bringing out ESP, particularly the clairvoyant form, in some people. You know, it doesn't work with everybody. It doesn't work all the time.
No.
And sometimes you get enough to know that something is happening, but it's not useful. And sometimes it's clear enough that it's practically useful.
When it works, it's pretty dramatic.
Yeah, right.
I mean, I've always wondered, for example, did they use remote viewing when they finally tracked down bin Laden? Who knows?
Well, a colleague of mine, Stephen Schwartz, did a remote viewing experiment and with a group of people, and they came up with drawings of bin Laden in an underground cave, all shaggy looking and so forth. This is all on the record, probably on his website somewhere or something like that. So, you know, I don't think that they use that for their operations, because by that time the government was denying any interest in this sort of thing. But frankly, I think remote viewing worked enough that it's negligent of our intelligence services to not use it. Now, let me say something there, too, because when I first had the opportunity to consult on this, I was very ambivalent about this. You know, I'm supposedly a spiritual kind of guy, and military funding and intelligence operations and all that.
You're probably saying, what am I getting involved in?
Exactly. But then Hal Puthoff said, you know, one of the main reasons wars start is because one side thinks it can get the drop on the other. And when there's good intelligence and you think, no, I can't surprise them, I don't have that advantage, a lot of wars don't start. So good intelligence is actually something for helping to keep peace. I say, yeah, okay. It's more complicated like any human activity, but basically this is a good thing to do. So I was happy to be consulting on that.
PK, psychokinesis. What have you looked at there?
The main thing I've looked at also illustrates the psychological problems I had with that. In my End of Materialism book, I have a chapter devoted to psychokinesis, and I particularly tried, I described an experiment I did in which what people tried to influence was a spinning silver dollar. Okay, you take a nice shiny silver dollar, give it a real hard spin or something like that, and you try to influence it to fall either heads or tails. And it's kind of nice from a scientific point of view because you know, it's going to come out 50-50 if your mind is not affecting it at all. And, you know, it might be biased one way a little bit or the other, but you can balance all that out. And I came up with this wonderful Rube Goldberg apparatus for spinning the coin automatically and all that. And I had sort of so-so results with it, but it showed how you could go about it. And as I was finally proofreading my book before it went off to the publisher, I remembered what got me started on this, that I had seen somebody who claimed that he could influence a spinning coin that way, and I tried to do it, you know, tilting the coin and things like that. I couldn't do anything. And at one point, he finally said, I'll tell you the secret, and you tilt the coin like this, and I started spinning about 75% heads. For a few minutes, I started to realize, wait a minute, I already tried that. Besides, if you spin the coin hard, it straightens up anyway. But what really got me was I went back to check the figures on the statistics on how significant my experiments had been, and I completely forgot that Andrea Puharik, the guy I was working with at the time, and I had done a formal test with this guy where I spun the coin, Puharik kept a record of it, and this guy sat off to the side so he couldn't blow on it or anything like that. And we said in advance, we're going to do 100 tries. We're going to try for heads every time. And we got 100 heads. And I had completely forgotten that. That was the most amazing PK demonstration I've personally ever seen. And, you know, at some level, it was too much for my mind. I forgot about it. I had to read what I'd written 30 years before it came back to me.
What did you think, and what do you think of someone like Uri Geller?
Well, I think Uri is reliably able to produce chaos when he's in any laboratory setting. So most of the people who've worked with him in the laboratory have said, we just couldn't control this experiment well enough. So I don't really know, okay? I also think somebody who's in a public psychic position like that is under enormous pressure to perform, and I would be tempted to cheat if I didn't have the talent coming on that light. I don't know if Geller does it. You know, I haven't been there 99.99% of the time. But I sure wish there'd been even more research with him and it had been done under more careful
conditions. Right, right. You know, he didn't do it when he was on the Johnny Carson show a long time ago. And people still ridicule him for that.
Yeah, and you know, it's really hard. It's like if you were doing some sex research, right? You know, and we put you on the Johnny Carson show and said, okay, George, demonstrate an erection right now. Well, wait a minute.
Let's come up with a better example, huh, Charlie?
Oh, that's a terrible one, I know. But, you know, I'm trying to say, you know, that whatever psychokinesis is for most people, it's certainly a pretty delicate talent. And if psychological conditions aren't right, you may not be able to do it.
Let's go back to the End of Materialism.
Okay, it's safer there.
Much safer. which a little work in spiritual mystical experiences. Tell me about the psychiatrist, R.M. Buck.
Oh, yeah. This was a psychiatrist in the 1800s. I forget the exact date. Who was an ordinary guy who had this profound mystical experience that he called cosmic consciousness. In fact, it's so profound that if you'll give me a moment, I'll grab a copy of the book and read a few sentences of that. Is that okay with you?
What are you going to do, leave?
No, but I have to get up and go over to the bookcase here.
Well, let's do that later during the break.
Okay. Right. And this changed his life so much, okay? Here it is.
Mm-hmm.
I thought, here it is. Which chapter is it in?
Live radio.
Yeah, we mustn't have a moment of silence, right?
No, none. Not even a second.
Yeah, well, that's okay. Humming is pretty good.
Well, it depends on who's doing the humming.
I'll be darned. I'm having a hard time finding it.
Well, then let's move on to another question.
Okay.
How many people in the world of science, if you asked them today if they believed in life after death, would say, I do?
If they're speaking in their role as a scientist, the vast majority of them would say no. That idea makes no sense at all. It's nonsensical.
I would say that too.
If you get them to speak as a person rather than staying in their role as a scientist, then a much higher proportion would say it, but they wouldn't say it among their scientist colleagues.
Based on all your years of research and study, what have you concluded about all this?
Oh, I think it's very likely that we survive death in some form, and that we are spiritual creatures. And I'm going to illustrate that now because I have found the quote I was looking for a moment ago from this Canadian physician, R.M. Buck.
All right.
He says, it was in the early morning at the beginning of his 36th year. He and two friends had spent the evening reading Wordsworth, Shelley, Keats, Browning, and especially Walt Whitman. They parted at midnight, and he had a long drive in a hansom cab in an English city. His mind deeply under the influences of the ideas and images and emotions called up by the talk of the evening was calm and peaceful. He was in a state of quiet. All at once, without warning of any kind, he found himself wrapped around, as it were, by a flame-colored cloud. For an instant, he thought of fire, some sudden conflagration in the great city. The next, he knew that the light was within himself. Directly afterwards came upon him a sense of exaltation, of immense joyousness, accompanied or immediately followed by an intellectual illumination quite impossible to describe. Into his brain streamed one momentary lightning flash of the Brahmic splendor, which has ever since lightened his life. Upon his heart fell one drop of Brahmic bliss, leaving thence afterward for always an aftertaste of heaven. Among other things, he did not come to believe, but he saw and knew, was that the cosmos is not dead matter, but a living presence, that the soul of man is immortal, that the universe is so built and ordered that without any peradventure, all things work together for the good in each of all, and that the foundation principle of the world is what we call love, and that the happiness of everyone is, in the long run, absolutely certain. He claims he learned more within the few seconds during which this illumination lasted that in previous years of study, and that what he learned much, and that he learned much that no study could ever have taught.
See, now, he knew. This guy knew.
This guy knew, yeah. I mean, this is a classical mystical experience. He called it cosmic consciousness. And what is especially interesting, too, is that practically 100 years later, I was at a conference with some medical and scientific people, and an anesthesiologist I was getting to know turned out to have had almost exactly the identical experience. He knew nothing about this psychiatrist, Buck. He wasn't interested in spiritual things. He was an intellectual atheist, that sort of thing. Same kind of thing happened to him. This is the kind of deep spiritual experience that can totally change a person's life.
It's like an epiphany, isn't it?
It's an epiphany, yeah.
Well, it's pretty dramatic, it's happened to a lot of people.
I get goosebumps even when I just read that particular thing, and I've read it many times now.
Did this happen to you that way, or did you just evolve into it?
No. I've never had that kind of experience. I wish I had. On the other hand, sometimes I think maybe I'm not supposed to actually have the experience, because then if I had the experience, none of my scientist colleagues would believe in my sanity. But if I haven't had any experience, they'll trust me more. That's a very odd way of thinking, but it enables me to do better work to get other scientists to listen to what I have to say about this kind of stuff.
Are more and more scientists changing? Coming on board?
The ones I know, but then I know a pretty selected group of scientists who are interested in this sort of thing. Still, I think the majority are still caught up in the standard old materialistic view of things.
That'll change, won't it?
It's all right in one way. I mean, this is a material world, and I'm happy if we learn more about how it works and are better able to control disease and energy problems and all that. But it's when the materialistic view claims that it's total view, that's when I depart.
Do you think
people's spirituality, that's when it's actually hurting people.
Do you think an atheist is empty within themselves?
No, I think they're just as human as all the rest of us, but they're in a kind of denial. I actually get amused by atheists nowadays because, you know, if you say there's no God, that's sort of like saying, I am so intelligent that I can tell you there is no creature in the universe more intelligent than me. Wow, what a statement. Now, if that was a more reasonable statement that I don't know whether there's a God or not, yeah, that's an intelligent thing to say. Or if a person would say, the way God is described in the Old Testament or something like that, I don't believe in him. Yeah, I could go along with that. I could make that same statement myself. Whatever God is, it's something or someone or some force that's a lot better than these early primitive attempts to describe that sort of thing.
But you do not believe...
People have a hard time when they have near-death experiences, incidentally, because they meet this incredible being of light who reads their mind, who loves them and all that, and they hate to say they met God, but, you know, it's hard not to admit that something special went on.
What about the devil?
That's very rare in near-death experiences. Probably something like 5% of near-death experiences are negative or frightening or the like. It may be more. People may just be ashamed to talk about it. You know, when I died, I went to hell. Who wants to admit that? But it seems more like they're afraid of the strange experience rather than the experience itself being inherently negative. We need a lot more research on that one, incidentally.
Well, we do, but I've heard of psychic vampires. You have too, right? People who drain your energy.
Well, I've certainly met people like that on an ordinary life.
Oh, sure.
Energy drains, right? I try to get away from them as quickly as possible.
So there's got to, and we know there's evil. You agree with that?
No.
You don't?
No. Like I said earlier in the show, I'm personally biased against that. I don't like the idea of evil, and I think the nasty stuff we humans are capable of is more than sufficient. For instance,
yeah, but wouldn't you call that? What would you call that? What would you call the Hitlers of the world?
I'd call them very sick people. I'd call them people whose minds have been really warped. For example, okay, I'm a very peaceful person. I've never had to really hurt anybody.
Okay,
but if I saw somebody threatening my family and I had a gun available,
you become a monster, don't you?
Well, I tried to be calm about it, but I know also some part of me would enjoy being powerful and defending myself that way.
Well, yeah, absolutely. And I think many people would. Many people would. We're going to come back in just a moment. We're going to take your phone calls now on Coast to Coast AM and also your stories, as we've talked about, psychokinesis, remote viewing, near-death experiences. I'd like your story. Share them with us. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.